And welcome back to Midday, everyone. Dan Rodrigues here. Thanks again for joining us. In the Latino community, Cesar Chavez is a heroic figure. Schools, boulevards, plazas, and libraries are named in his honor. His birthday is an official holiday in three states. For many, he was the first authentic national voice of marginalized Mexican Americans, and one of the first with a major political impact. He's remembered as the founder of the United Farm Workers, which brought powerful California growers to the bargaining table with a national grape boycott. Our next guest, biographer Miriam Powell, says Cesar Chavez was also a master of political theater, whose tough but peaceful tactics improved the lives of thousands of impoverished workers. To many, he was a near mystical visionary whose personal fasts gave him a Gandhi-like national presence. But in the first comprehensive biography of the labor leader, Miriam Powell notes that Cesar Chavez's spectacular rise in the 1960s was followed by a long descent that left his union in tatters, his friends, supporters, and allies embittered, and his own reputation tarnished. A journalist who has written extensively about the farm workers' movement, Miriam Powell argues that Cesar Chavez was a complex, charismatic hero with very human flaws. Chavez's near saintly national image masked serious management and personal flaws. He was better at organizing workers than running a successful union. Miriam Powell also documents a controlling, vengeful, almost paranoid personality. Moving the union's headquarters to La Paz, an abandoned mountain sanitarium, Cesar Chavez lost touch with his membership, flirted with a sinister cult-like movement called Sinanon, and launched frequent purges of union leadership that left the UFW virtually powerless. Today, fewer than 5,000 agricultural workers remain organized. But Miriam Powell notes that Cesar Chavez is still remembered as a hero among Latinos for giving them a voice and showing they could be a serious force in American political and economic life. Our guest, Miriam Powell, is a distinguished reporter, editor, and author who spent 25 years at the Los Angeles Times and at Newsday, where the staff she directed won a Pulitzer Prize for their coverage of the 1996 crash of TWA Flight 800 off the coast of Long Island. Turning to long-form journalism, Miriam Powell wrote The Union of Their Dreams, a history of the UFW movement, and that brought her to a fellowship from the National Endowment for the Humanities for her latest book, The Crusades of Cesar Chavez, a biography. It's available from the Bloomsbury Press. Miriam Powell, I want to welcome you to Midday on WYPR. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
I'm one of those baby boomers who still goes to the supermarket, sees a pile of grapes from California, and thinks of Cesar Chavez and asks, is it okay to buy grapes in 2014?
And you are totally not the only one who says that. I've heard that a lot.
I'm good. I'm glad to hear that. Because, you know, even for older boomers, particularly here on the East Coast, a lot of the events that you describe in your book seem long ago and far away. So before we get into Cesar himself, I think our listeners under 50 may be too young to remember all this. So you could maybe start by telling us what life was like for farm workers in California and many other areas of the country back in the early 1960s when the story of Cesar Chavez is organizing them begins.
Right. That's a really good point. And in some ways, sadly, life is not all that different for farm workers today. And we can get to that later. But, you know, Cesar Chavez was born in Arizona and grew up on his grandfather's farm. And when the family lost the farm, he was 12 years old and he joined and at that point became a migrant farm worker himself. His family became farm workers. And he at a very early age experienced what it was like to be a farm worker. And just to put it in a little bit of context that I think listeners will kind of be able to identify with that, he comes to California in 1939, and the Chavez family becomes migrant farm workers just about the same time that The Grapes of Wrath is published. And so for those who remember what the Jode family faced, those were what the conditions were like for farm workers when Cesar as a child first becomes part of that world. And, you know, in addition to what the Jode family faced, of course, he was a Mexican American. And in that day, there was not much distinction made between Mexicans and Mexican Americans for many white people. And so he also faced this sort of pervasive discrimination and racism that was very common in the fields then. So the work was both very physically difficult and brutal. And then there was also, you know, perhaps more importantly, a real loss of dignity and a lack of respect. So farm workers were sort of treated as, in many senses, no more than interchangeable parts like farm implements. There were then, and in many cases, in some ways still are, this is true today as well, farm workers were exempt from almost all health, safety, and labor laws that governed working conditions for most other workers. That's a little bit better now in terms of health and safety laws, but in many ways, you know, things like overtime are also not common today. Mm-hmm. So it was both difficult and also sort of a demeaning existence.
I remember seeing in journalism school, I think for the first time, Edward R. Murrow's documentary or CBS white paper, Harvest of Shame, which
yes.
I believe was what, in Miriam, that was in the 50s, was it not?
It was 1960. That came
60.
Out in
okay.
right Thanksgiving of 1960. Yeah, uh-huh. So that's very much current to his time.
So in the cycle, I'm just noticing from the book here, the cycle of the work of the migrant workers in California, picking peas and lettuce in the winter, cherries and beans in the spring, corn and grapes in the summer, cotton in the fall. Cesar Chavez quit school in the seventh grade so that his mother wouldn't have to work in the fields. Is that right?
Eighth grade. Eighth grade. And that was not uncommon also because not only did he need to work to support the family, as many farm worker kids did, but there also was, you know, so much discrimination in the schools that the Mexican kids were viewed, there was, well, why should you continue in school because you're just going to be a farm worker anyway? What do you need to be educated for? So that experience that he had was also, you know, quite common. I mean, he probably had more school than many farm workers did.
He gets to, and I want to make sure I pronounce the town correctly. Is it Delano or Delano?
Delano,
California. Because I associate that name with, of course, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, but also Delano and the later the boycott of grapes.
Yes. Right. Yes. So Delano, right. Mm-hmm. Delano is in the heart. It is now a much larger city, but it was about 12,000 people. It's in the heart that at that time when he moved there. It's in the heart of the Central Valley, and that there was the center, it still is, of the table grape industry. And you know, we should backing up a little bit in the 1950s. I mean, after being a farm worker, he spent almost 10 years working for what was really the first civil rights organization for Mexican Americans in California. It was called the Community Service Organization, and learns to be an organizer, really sort of learns the craft. He kept journals and diaries, which are kind of wonderful day by day. You can sort of see how he learns to actually go out and organize people. And then in 1962, he makes this decision that is, I think, one of his most brave moments, where he walks away from a fairly well-paying job, being a community organizer, and takes his family, his wife and 8 children, to Delano, which is kind of, you know, the middle of nowhere in some sense. And but he had family there, and his wife had family, and he knew that it was sort of a central point for agricultural workers because it was so much in the heart of the country there. So he moves there with the idea of forming a union for farm workers, which had been tried before. He was certainly not the first person, and there actually even was an existing organizing committee chartered by the AFL-CIO at that point that was trying to organize farm workers but not doing it very effectively. So he sets out and kind of just travels around the Central Valley talking to people one by one and trying to set up what, you know, and does set up what becomes the precursor to the United Farm Workers.
Miriam, have you figured out what gave him the bug to even do this, to become associated, first of all, with Community Service Organization in L.A., to become an activist, to become more than just a guy working at, I think, one point he had a job in a lumber yard, more right. than a worker, a farm worker. What gave him the bug for this?
Well, you know, obviously he was extremely intelligent and very curious about the world, becomes later an avid reader and a very, you know, self-taught, well-read, and had both a combination of sort of an intensity and an understanding of power and an interest in power and how you get power. And then from his personal experience, had knew what it was like to work in the fields firsthand and understood the inequality and the and really wanted to do something about that outrage and had a sort of single-minded intensity about him that allowed him to be such an effective organizer and such a visionary. He also grew up with a sense of the importance of service. His mother was a really important influence on him in this, and she always sort of instilled in her kids a sense of the importance of sacrificing to help others, even if you didn't have a lot yourself. So, you know, he says at one point in time that the two things that made him do this were a sense of the importance of serving others and what he calls a sort of a fanaticism in the sense that when he set out to do something, he just was going to do it no matter what. So,
and he went
that
from
single-mindedness.
Okay. And that single-mindedness, it seemed to be focused on a more of a general poor people's movement than on labor organizing at first, right? Would you say that's true?
I would say that's true, and not only at first, but throughout his career. And I think that that's one of the things that leads to some conflict within the organization later on. But he certainly, I mean, for him, this was very much about organizing poor people and empowering poor people who had, you know, and I think in many ways that's his great legacy and one of the reasons that his story is still so powerful and so important and relevant today is that what he was able to demonstrate was that the poorest workers who had really nothing to give to this fight but their own lives could, through collective action and brilliant sort of strategic leadership, overcome, you know, enormous odds and achieve power. So that was his vision. And for him, farm workers were the first piece of that because that was where he came from and that was his own experience. And he felt the need to do something to help people who were in that situation.
We're speaking with Miriam Powell, Pulitzer Prize winning journalist and expert on the condition of farm workers in the West. And most recently, the author of The Crusades of Cesar Chavez, which tells the story of the flawed hero who began organizing grape growers in the 1960s, eventually founding the United Farm Workers Union. As we go into our break, we'll listen to an excerpt from a speech that Cesar Chavez gave once. We'll hear his voice throughout this hour of midday. A short break, let's listen in, and then we'll continue our conversation.
Like the other immigrant groups, the day will come when we win the economic and political rewards which are in keeping with our numbers in society. The day will come when the politicians will do the right thing for our people out of political necessity and not out of charity or idealism. Once social change begins, it cannot be reversed. You cannot uneducate the person who has learned to read. You cannot humiliate the person who feels pride. You cannot oppress the people who are not afraid anymore.
The voice of Cesar Chavez, subject of a new book by our guest in this hour, Miriam Powell, a journalist and author who's written this new biography of a man whose name you'll recognize if you're old enough to remember the grape boycotts of the 1960s and 70s. They were the work of Cesar Chavez, who began organizing grape growers in the mid-1960s, founded a union that became eventually the United Farm Workers, in many ways was the original national voice of Mexican Americans as a political and social force in American society. Back with Miriam Powell. So let's go to Delano. I think the year is 1965 and the grape boycott that so many of us remember.
Right. So the boycott begins a little bit late, begins towards the end of 65, but really takes off a little bit later than that. On September 8th, 1965, the largely Filipino-American union that was chartered by the AFL-CIO begins what becomes the five-year grape strike. And they sit down, the Filipinos are striking because they're asking for $1.40 an hour and the growers are paying $1.25. And so they begin this strike, and they recognize that if the Mexicans do not honor the strike and cross the picket lines, then the strike will be over very quickly. So they go to Cesar Chavez and ask him to for his organization, which was then called the National Farm Workers Association, to join the strike. And he calls a meeting on September 16th, Mexican Independence Day, and they vote to join the strike. And that begins what leads us into the boycott. The strike itself gets some attention, but not a whole lot. And the people who respond to the strike are the sort of politically aware student volunteers, in many cases, from the San Francisco Bay Area. This is, you know, the we're coming out of the Mississippi summer, which is the 50th anniversary this year. So you have kind of a lot of response from people who see this as the next civil rights battle. But striking a grape field is a very, very tough thing, because it's not like striking a plant. You have people who are in vineyards that cover hundreds and hundreds of acres. So they're striking, but they're getting a lot of, you know, not a whole lot of success in terms of stopping the harvest of the grapes. And they come up with this idea that if we can't stop the grapes where they're being harvested, we can try to block them from being sold. This also comes to some degree out of the civil rights movement, because the boycotts of lunch counters and the bus boycotts from the South are still very fresh in people's minds. So they begin this boycott, and it's it really draws in people around the country and helps to build this movement and to sort of really raise the consciousness of national consciousness of farm workers. And one of the things that becomes key, I mean, there are lots of people who help and make the boycott successful. I mean, Baltimore was a big boycott city. Much of the Northeast, Boston, Chicago were very successful. And it was because of labor and religious groups and student groups and all sorts of people who joined in the support. But the other thing that Chavez did that was sort of part one of a classic example of his strategic brilliance was that he took farm workers, many of whom had never been on planes, had not been outside of California, didn't speak English, and sent them to these cities around the country with the mandate to stop the sale of grapes. And, you know, they didn't have money. They were relying on the kindness of strangers, and they were able to sort of use that so effectively, because the personal appeal of someone saying, you know, I'm 19 years old, I'm a farm worker from Delano, California, I've left my family and my whole world, and I'm asking you to just do this very simple thing, which is to please don't buy grapes in order to help farm workers like me in California. You know, and that just mushroomed and was able to really, you know, build both support for the farm workers themselves and to sort of turn Chavez into the national icon that he became.
Yeah, you know, I have a distinct memory, as do I'm sure many listeners in our audience, of this event and those years, 65, 66, 67, because it took a few years for the message to set in. But It seemed like the word spread rather quickly. And I want to ask you this question, Miriam, and looking back at this history, the sympathy for this strike, the boycott, grapes are a fairly easy thing for people to give up
exactly.
To show their sympathy. Okay, you're not asking me to stop eating food. You're just asking me to give up table grapes to show my support, and later maybe iceberg lettuce. We'll get to that in a minute. But so is that the genius of this particular strike? It was that you were asking Americans to give up something fairly easy to give up.
I think that's certainly an important part of it. And the lettuce boycott, as you mentioned, the lettuce boycott, you know, was never nearly as successful as grapes, because lettuce for people was a necessity in many cases, whereas grapes is a luxury item. So much easier to convince people to not eat grapes than lettuce. It tapped into a lot of things. You know, it tapped into a sense of people wanting to feel good about themselves by helping this. It also, again, you know, was coming out of the civil rights movement. You had people who were looking for another cause, and it sort of tapped into that reservoir of feeling across the country. The other thing that we should talk about is that what really wins the boycott is not individual consumers not buying grapes, but supermarket chains and supermarket executives being fed up with the protests. And this is an example of what Chavez called organizational jujitsu, which is using the strength of your opponent against the opponent himself. And it's a great example of it because farm workers were and still are not covered under the National Labor Relations Act, which sort of sets up, you know, basic procedures for elections and unionization in workplaces. So the growers view this as a protection, that there was no mechanism for workers to demand an election and demand to join a union. What Chavez was able to do was turn them against them. Because farm workers are not covered by the NLRA, they're also not subject to its restrictions. And one of the things that you can't do under the NLRA is what's called a secondary boycott. And that is when I ask you not only don't buy grapes, but don't shop at Safeway if they're selling non-union grapes. And that is what really wins the boycott for the farm workers in 1970. It's the pressure on a few of the really large supermarket chains. And, you know, they just made pests of themselves. They had priests praying over grapes in the supermarket aisles and candlelight vigils outside the houses of supermarket executives. And ultimately, the key supermarket people said, you know what, we have labor problems too, and we have contracts with our workers. And they went back to the growers and said, you need to solve this problem. You know, you need to make this go away. And that's what leads to this tremendous victory in July 1970, where virtually all the table grape growers in California sign union contracts.
Wow. You know, I was thinking about this, how remarkable it is, really, when you look back on it. I'm so glad we have you to explain the history. I wonder how deep the sympathy was, you know, beyond grapes. I know that Cesar Chavez and this movement made more Americans aware of, you know, the cost of food, why food is, you know, relatively cheap in the United States, is because the labor that provides it is so cheap, especially fruit and vegetables that come from California and the Southwest. And I wonder today, here we are, you know, what, 50 years later, is sympathy any deeper for those workers than it was then in that time, in that moment?
You know, I think that the sympathy is there. I think that it has to be tapped into and people have to be sort of made aware. And a good example of that right today is a group called the Coalition of Immokalee Workers in Florida, which has been waging a battle for quite effectively and successfully for the last few years to increase the wages for the tomato pickers in Florida. And they've had this penny a pound campaign, and they've successfully boycotted major chains like Taco Bell, and they were even sort of threatening at one point a boycott of Trader Joe's, and have tapped again into the students and, you know, boycotts on campus and things like that. And again, it's kind of just raising that awareness. I think when people are confronted with the conditions of workers and asked whether they'd be willing to pay a few cents more for tomatoes in order for people to have a living wage and a decent way of life, that they overwhelmingly respond positively. But it takes a lot of effort to bring those conditions out and to bring those issues before the American public.
You're listening to Midday on WYPR. Dan Rodericks here with my guest, Miriam Powell, author of The Crusades of Cesar Chavez, a biography of Cesar Chavez, published by Bloomsbury Press. Miriam, Dale, one of our listeners calling in to make a comment about the grape boycott before we move on with the history from there. Dale, thanks for calling. Go right ahead.
Thanks. I had a comment and a question. I wanted to comment to you about our family. We supported the boycott. We didn't buy grapes or lettuce. For years, my father was a steel worker, and we really stood shoulder to shoulder with the plight of any working person that was demanding their rights as individuals. The question was, do you think that the farm workers union failed because it never got expanded further than basically a California Southwest regional type of thing? Where the farms are, we have farms throughout the country, mm-hmm. and the fact that after a lot of our Mexican Americans started leaving the fields, and that the influx of undocumented individuals all over the world that now dominate the agriculture industry in our country now, even here in Maryland, which is almost 3,000 miles from any port of entry, do you think that diluted and made us more indifferent to the plight of farm workers because most of them are not Americans?
Right. I think that's a good question. You know, I think that some of the great successes that the union had, even back in the sort of its heyday in the late 1970s, were in winning support from and contracts for undocumented workers. I mean, certainly the percentage of farm workers who were here illegally was not as high then as it is today, but there still was a substantial portion of the workforce in California that was not here legally. And that posed sort of, you know, extra hurdles in terms of organizing. I just want to go back to the first thing you said, too, to just because I think it's a good point that a lot of the success, and especially in the early years of the Farm Workers Union, was because of labor solidarity. I mean, it was a period in this country where there was relatively strong support for labor and unions were relatively doing well, certainly compared to today. And that support across the country from steelworkers, from the auto workers, from laborers, from all sorts of organized labor was, you know, was really key to the success and to the survival of the union in its early years.
At its peak, the union that became the United Farm Workers reached about 80,000. Is that right?
I think that's probably about right. It's really hard to quantify numbers exactly because, you know, farm work is seasonal. It was even more seasonal then. And so whether you count the number of jobs that are covered under contracts or the number of workers who fill those jobs, you know, the numbers sort of fluctuate a lot. But something in that range. And the peak of membership for the UFW were those July 1970 contracts that were signed with the grape growers. They, you know, expanded into other fruits and vegetables later on, but never again actually had as many members as they did at that point in time.
And to Dale's point about undocumented workers, Miriam, just wanted to ask you about this because this is really interesting to me. Cesar Chavez was never a champion of those people, of undocumented workers. In fact, it seems like he did his best to prevent border jumping because he was worried about strike breakers.
That's correct. The union did a couple of things that in 1974, Chavez launched what he called the Illegals Campaign, in which he directed all the staff members of the union to go out and find workers who were here illegally and report them to what was then the INS and try to get them deported. And he did that in the name of preventing people from breaking strikes, but there was a much deeper issue, and there were also other things that the union did and financed, including what's called the wet line along the border, wet line from what was then a fairly commonly used term, wetback, and the wet line was set up as the UFW's border patrol to try to stop people from crossing the border. So there was a strong anti-immigrant strain, and I think that, you know, it's complicated. The border was very different then than it is today. It was a very porous border. It was not, you know, the militarized border that it is at the moment. So crossing was not that difficult. But Chavez's feelings about immigrants, I think, are really important and complicated and kind of go to the complexity of the man because he believed that it was really important to teach people the value of sacrifice and sacrificing for others, and that people should be comfortable and not, you know, have dignity and respect and live in comfort and not live in poverty, but that they should not forget where they came from. And he really had tremendous disdain for what he considered middle class values and was determined to try to build an organization that did not turn farm workers into complacent middle class people. And, you know, this becomes a very tricky road to navigate, as you can imagine, and it's a very atypical position for a labor leader to take. And he wasn't a typical labor leader. In fact, in many ways, probably didn't even consider himself a labor leader and had a lot of disdain for the traditional labor movement. And so if you're, you know, he talks a lot on tapes, which he made. He made hundreds of tape recordings that were preserved in the archives and that I drew on extensively in writing the book. And he talks a lot about the need to educate workers about the importance of sacrifice. And when you think about that, he was certainly very aware that immigrants, whether they are here legally or illegally, if, you know, they come here in order to make money for the most part, and most of them have responsibilities to families back home and are here to make money and send money home. And many of them come with the idea of ultimately making enough money to go back and live in Mexico. And so that need to make money poses for him an extra hurdle in this quest to educate them about the value of sacrifice and of collective action.
Miriam Powell is our guest. We're talking about Cesar Chavez, the subject of her new biography, The Crusades of Cesar Chavez, and more as we go into the break here, more of the voice of Cesar Chavez on Midday. We'll take a short break and be right back.
The UFW was the beginning. We attacked that historical source of shame and infamy that our people in this country lived with. We attacked that injustice not by complaining, not by seeking handouts, not by becoming soldiers in the war on poverty. We organized. The Union's survival, its very existence, sent out a signal to all Hispanics that we were fighting for our dignity, that we were challenging and overcoming injustice, that we were empowering the least educated among us, the poorest among us.
In the explosion of protests and revolts against authority that characterized the 1960s and 70s, it's easy for Americans, particularly here in the East, to forget a labor movement that began in the fields of California, where long marginalized field hands found a hero in a charismatic, politically savvy community organizer named Cesar Chavez, who founded the National Farm Workers Union, rode it to meteoric success, and ultimately saw it dissolve into chaos and recrimination, largely of his own doing. He's the subject of Miriam Powell's book, The Crusades of Cesar Chavez. Miriam Powell, our guest here on Midday. And Miriam, I just want to touch on the lettuce boycott a little bit and then start talking about the years after that and Cesar Chavez. I think early 1970s, we had the salad boycott. I seem to associate that with iceberg lettuce in particular.
Yes, that's exactly right. Iceberg lettuce, which was then, we didn't have like 16 different kinds of lettuce then. So,
yeah, right.
Iceberg was the common lettuce, and it was head lettuce. It was, not in bags and things the way we think of lettuce often today. So the Teamsters came in. I mean, it's a complicated saga, but there was just sort of one dramatic battle after another, and no sooner that were the grape contracts and the great victory achieved in 1970 than the Teamsters came in and signed sweetheart deals contracts with the major lettuce growers in the Salinas Valley, which is the salad bowl of the world. And so there then is this kind of multi-year struggle that goes really sort of into 1975 to try to wrest those contracts away from the Teamsters, which were then a very discredited union. They'd been thrown out of the AFL-CIO, and they had done this thing which was really anathema to the rest of the labor movement, which is to come in and essentially sort of, steal someone else's contract away. And for the growers, the Teamsters represented a very malleable union that allowed them to say, well, we have union lettuce, which was something that really confused the boycott. I mean, it was much more difficult to try to tell people that, yes, it's union lettuce, but it's a bad union. It's not our union. And, so there was the message on the lettuce boycott was never as clear cut, always a lot harder to articulate for the UFW.
Hmm. When we get to the I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, ultimately, what ends that, which we should just touch on, is in 1975, Jerry Brown, who was once again governor here in California, but had just been elected governor the first time. And he really this was an important issue for him personally. He'd been involved with the farm workers and puts his personal sort of prestige and political clout on the line in negotiating what becomes the California Agricultural Labor Relations Act, passed in 1975, to this day the only law in the country that guarantees, it's a very strong pro-labor law and gives labor unions tremendous rights to organize and protects concerted union activity in the fields. And that ushers in just a whole new era for the UFW, because there are all of these elections and then contracts to negotiate and administer and so on. It becomes much more of a traditional labor union.
Cesar Chavez became a real star during that period of time, a real folk hero here in America. I remember seeing his face on posters. People of a certain age will remember this. Those younger may not. But he really had a meteoric rise through all of this, and associated with celebrities, had lots of political support, and political support that seemed to go to him rather than he to them.
I think that's very true. I mean, he's such a fascinating, charismatic figure because he's charismatic in a very unusual way. You know, he was not a good public speaker. He didn't like public speaking. So when you think of, you know, the charismatic figures of the era, like the Kings and Martin Luther King and the Kennedys, you know, he was not like that at all. He was short. He was unprepossessing looking. He was, as I said, not a very good talker. But he had this presence about him and this powerful sort of personal magnetism, and that people responded to what he had done rather than what he said. Mm. So the fasts and the marches and the sort of personal physical sacrifice that he was willing to endure for his cause were part of what lent him that particular charisma. And he did, he attracted, I mean, Bobby Kennedy is the most prominent probably symbol of political power that was drawn to the farm workers and to Chavez. And the image of Kennedy helping him break his first lengthy public fast in 1968 is, I think, one of sort of the iconic images of the movement and of that era.
But running a union on a day-to-day basis and executing contracts and sticking to contracts, that's the tough part. Well, it's all tough, but really, sustaining that over a long period of time, that wasn't Cesar Chavez's top skill, was it? Organizing was his thing.
That's right. I mean, he's certainly, you know, far from the first charismatic leader to be able to successfully build something and then not necessarily be the best person to run it. And he becomes really torn between, and you hear this sort of these anguished philosophical debates on the tape recordings of the executive board meetings from that time, because suddenly there is this enormous bureaucracy that's been created, and there are hundreds of contracts, and there are workers who are making demands, and they are not necessarily ideologically in tune with you. They might just want money. They may want to be middle class. But the bureaucracy itself of the organization, he sort of struggles to figure out a way to make that run efficiently and not to relinquish control, because it's very, very hard for him to delegate effectively. I mean, he just can't bring himself to do it. And he brings in management consultants and helps to figure out a flowchart for the union and explains to people that in order to grow, you have to delegate authority to people and then hold them accountable. And that's how we can make the system run. And he knows that, but he can't quite bring himself to do it. And so the sort of this paradoxical sense, the larger the union gets and the more successful it is in terms of winning elections and being in a position to negotiate and administer hundreds of contracts, the more that is drawing him away from what he really views as his mission, which is organizing poor people. And, you know, he calls the business of running the union, he refers to as non-missionary work. And it's not fundamentally what excites him. Mm-hmm. So there is this very rocky transition period from it's one thing to be so great at fighting battles, and then it's another thing to govern in peacetime. And that's a tough pivot to make.
There are a couple of things that happened in the years subsequent to that that I want you to talk about, Miriam. They seem almost bizarre to me. The decision to move UFW headquarters to La Paz. Could you tell us about that, please?
Sure. La Paz is now a national historic, it's part of the National Park Service, actually. It was President Obama declared it a National Historic Monument a couple of years ago. It is a old tuberculosis sanatorium in the foothills of the Tehachapi Mountains. It's kind of in the middle of nowhere. It's quite beautiful. And it appealed to Chavez because he was very interested in the concept of collectives and of places where you could live communally. And he sort of saw that as a way out of this dilemma of how do you empower people and improve their quality of life and yet not want them to aspire to be middle class and make a lot of money. And he sort of saw some form of collective living as a as a possible way out of that dilemma. And so La Paz appealed to him as a place where he could have the union headquarters and also sort of be an educational retreat. There were all these sort of ramshackle, rundown old hospital buildings there and little houses and at some points in time, lots of trailers. So you had as many as maybe 200 people living there at certain points in time, because the other important thing that we should touch on is that the union was of almost, not entirely, but largely a volunteer operation. People worked for $5 a week and room and board. And this becomes later on, again, a sort of important philosophical fight within the union, because how do you really administer an institution efficiently when you have a rotating sort of cast of characters of people who are volunteering? But to him, that was a really important principle. So the decision to move to La Paz comes actually very early. He moves the union there in 1971, and it disturbs some people at the time. There's a concern about him moving away from the fields and into the sort of foothills of the mountains and being isolated there, and that gets talked about a lot in the early years. But it's something that, you know, was really important to him.
You know, it sounds in some way idyllic, but for a labor leader, I mean, it's hard to imagine Jimmy Hoffa living like that, or Walter Reuther,
right.
Or somebody like
or
that.
Or Walter Reuther, exactly.
Right. Now, Synanon is another thing I want to ask you about here, because my association with Synanon goes way back also to the 70s, and people who were addicted to heroin going to someplace, maybe it was Haight-Ashbury, someplace like that, to live among the Synanon people, and it always sounded a little bizarre and strange to me. And Cesar Chavez got involved with Synanon.
Synanon started as a drug treatment program and got kind of remarkably favorable reviews, probably ultimately not quite justified, but it sort of morphed from this drug treatment program run by a man named Charles Dietrich, who was also a very charismatic figure in his own right and a reformed alcoholic. And he turns Synanon, he's a very effective businessman and gets people to donate lots and lots of money and parlays that into a sort of financial empire, buys a lot of land, and also has a vision of living in communities and builds what is this very kind of pristine, efficient, clean community that is really a cult, and tries to get Synanon declared a religion, and is the subject. And when by the time Chavez gets involved with Synanon, it's already been sort of being investigated for child abuse and for all sorts of kind of odd practices. And ultimately, Dietrich gets indicted for being involved in a plot to put a rattlesnake in the mailbox of an attorney who successfully sued the organization.
Oh, I remember this now.
It was, yeah, that was kind of, that's the thing people remember about Synanon. And yeah. Synanon played, I mean, the main sort of contribution, you know, for Chavez, it was a place that was sort of had certain things that appealed to him in the sense of being an intentional community and running smoothly. And what Dietrich tells him is that what you need, the tool to run this and the tool to make this transition into what you want to form the UFW into, is something called the game. And the game was devised as a treatment for drug addicts. It's sort of a very confrontational form of an encounter group, which was, popular in the 60s. And it involves kind of indicting some people sit in a circle. And the idea is that Dietrich explains that you have a triangle life, and the triangle life is your work life, where your boss is at the top of the triangle and people are below that. But in the game, in a circle, everyone is equal. And the idea is that you can then be free to say things that you would not be outside of the game. And the idea is to sort of curse as much as possible and be just sort of nasty and vicious and attack people with the idea of working out problems. And it becomes for, you know, non-addicts and people who are working and living together in La Paz, an incredibly destructive element.
You know, I mentioned Haight-Ashbury. Actually, Synanon was Santa Monica, California, wasn't it?
It was in Santa Monica, yeah. And then it moved up to Tomales Bay It was just north of San Francisco,
okay.
And that's kind of where a lot of the investigative stuff happened.
And we're running short of time here in our hour, Miriam, but that's why you wrote a biography of Cesar Chavez for more of the details. I just need to push up the clock a little bit here because there are a couple of things I wanted to cover with him. First of all, I remember when he died, he was fairly young. He was 66. By then, could you say that the UFW had lost most of its power by the time of his death in the 1990s?
Yes, it certainly had. I mean, the last decade of his life, they were not doing much in the fields, but he was, you know, increasingly in demand as a speaker. And the excerpts of the quotes that you play during the break come from this really remarkable speech he gave in 1984, where he talks about he's very visionary, and he foresaw, as he said, that whatever happened to the union at that point didn't even matter because of the example that had been given, and for people and especially for Latinos all over the country, of what people could do and how they could take on power. And I think, you know, so by the time he died, his importance was much greater in the cities than it was in the fields.
I was struck by the review of your book, The Crusades of Cesar Chavez, in the New York Times. These references or comparisons with Gandhi and Dr. King, Martin Luther King Jr. In closing this review, the writer says Chavez may have failed, whereas Gandhi and King did not. But Gandhi was up against the British Empire, which was an anachronism and on the way out. King was up against Jim Crow, which was an anachronism and on the way out. Cesar Chavez was up against the employers of America, and they get stronger every day.
Certainly some truth to that. I think that a lot of people who were involved in the union at the time would argue that there was a point in time where it could have succeeded and become an enduring labor union for farm workers in a way that it did not. What ultimately would have become of it, you know, 30 years later, who knows? But certainly he was up against the most powerful industry in California, but that's what makes his success so remarkable. That they were able to actually take on that force and achieve something that no one had done before.
Maybe it's simplistic, but my takeaway is get a charismatic guy to organize, get somebody else to run the front office, and keep things running well from day to day.
I think that's a good takeaway.
Yeah. Well, Miriam, I enjoyed our conversation, and thank you for your work on this and the earlier book, The Union of Their Dreams, about the farm workers. Miriam Powell has been our guest in this hour of midday. Again, the book is The Crusades of Cesar Chavez. Bloomsbury Press is the publisher. Thank you very much, Miriam.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah. And thank you, everybody, for tuning into our midday for today. We thank you, as always, for listening to our show. And we thank Atwaters for supplying lunch for our guests and sometimes our hungry staff here. Atwaters supports local radio, local farmers, and local appetites. Located at Belvedere Square, the shops at Kenilworth, Bear Hills, or Main Street, Catonsville, visit atwaters.biz for more information. Have a great afternoon, and we'll see you again soon.
Midday Senior Producer is Nikki Gamer. The Producer and Director is Jonathan Ahrens. The Associate Producer, Michael Himowitz. Our interns are Brian Gilbert, Tyler Downey, and Anna Muckerman. Music produced by Jeff Truman and High Gravity Sounds. Midday podcast and live streaming available at WYPR.org. Dan Roderick's column appears in the Baltimore Sun. This is WYPR, your NPR news station.